1950s was a very pivotal decade in Jewish life during the 20th century. Some of the things had to do with Jews themselves, most of the things had to do with outside events, outside influences, which greatly affected the Jewish world. There's a seat here. The main global event in the 1950s was the Cold War. Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met at Yalta in 1945 and came to what they thought was an agreement as to what the peacetime world would look like. But it fell apart. First of all, Roosevelt died. Churchill was voted out of office in a moment of gratitude of the British people. And Stalin became a great imperialist, struggling for territory. Russia wanted to, and eventually did, dominate Eastern Europe completely. All of the governments, there's a seat here, all of the governments of Eastern Europe were communist, run by Moscow. And Stalin had ambitions. His ambitions included Germany, Spain, and Italy, all of which Germany he occupied the eastern third of Germany. Spain and Italy had a very large communist party. France had a very large communist party. Spain was controlled by Franco, who was a dictator and who kept the communists from any dreams of power. But in France and in Italy, the communists in the elections won a sizable vote. And Stalin saw an opportunity for Russia to control all of Europe. There also were wars in Greece that the communists tried to depose the Greek government. The United States and Britain supported the government, and the government won the Civil War. Bitter, bitter Civil War full of atrocities. And Truman, who then was President of the United States, Truman had no illusions about Stalin. He was a very realistic, hard-headed person. Truman proclaimed the Truman Doctrine, meaning that Greece, Turkey, the Mediterranean were under the protection of the United States, and that if the Soviet Union attempted to conquer any of those countries by force, America would go to war. Now, this was at a period of time when the United States was the sole country in the world that possessed a nuclear bomb. And because of that, its word meant a great deal. But the Russians sponsored the Chinese communists. Mao Zedong was originally a tool of Moscow. There's a wonderful book, frightening to read, but it's a wonderful book, called Mao, M-A-O, The Untold Story. This Chinese woman and her British husband spent over 10 years researching the documents and interviewing people, and you see a picture of a person that is completely without any sense of morality. A Mao who killed 70 million of his own countrymen, and it meant nothing to him. And Stalin sponsored him, and the Chinese communist Mao was able to drive the Chinese nationalists who were supported by the United States out of the country. The nationalists fled to the island of Formosa, which today is Taiwan, and the Chinese communists took over the mainland. So you have these two enormous countries with enormous populations under the communist rule, and they were both expansionists. China invaded Tibet and took Tibet as a province of China. The Dalai Lama till today is in exile. And the Chinese and the communists supported a revolution in Vietnam against the French Indochina, which eventually drove the French out of the country. And in a peace conference, Vietnam was divided between the communist North and the non-communist South, which would lead to the Vietnamese War, because the communists intended to have the South as well, as they do today. The same thing is true of Korea. Korea was divided at the 38th parallel. The northern part was a communist state, and the southern part was under American protection. Now, Korea had been conquered by the Japanese. The Japanese treated the Koreans miserably. Even till today, there's very little love lost between them. So you had all of these hot spots all over the world, any one of which could flare into war. Yes?
What did China have to gain by becoming communist as opposed to being like one of the dictatorship?
Well, I mean, they didn't ask the Chinese people, you know.
No, the government.
The ruling body was killed by Mao, and he said he was the head of the Communist Party. He killed out everybody, and then you had a small, relatively small number of people run the whole hundreds of millions through terror, the same way that in Russia you had a small group of people running the hundreds of millions through terror.
So how is that different to a dictatorship?
Well, that's the dictatorship, is that whatever Mao said, that's what it was. Mao built himself into a god. He had the little red book that he used to recite verses that he said. He was supposed to be a genius. He swam the Yangtze River. He was, you know, was just as Stalin in Russia was the cult of the personality. I mean, God's revenge on all atheists is that he makes them gods. That's what happened. So you have all of these difficult places in the world. And to make it even more difficult, in 1952, the North Koreans, egged on by Russia, by Stalin, who's still alive, invaded South Korea. And they had initially a great success, and they drove the South Koreans out of their country, practically. The United States government backed the South Koreans, and they they were able to get a resolution passed in the United Nations condemning North Korea. And America sent soldiers. There are many of the soldiers from Japan and then from Hawaii, and then it became a full-scale war. And General Douglas MacArthur commanded the forces. And they were originally bottled up in a little place in Busan in the southern Korea. But MacArthur, in his generalship and his abilities, outmaneuvered the communists, and he drove them out of South Korea. And he drove them all the way up to the Chinese border, to the Yalu River. Then China entered the war. North Korea was done. America destroyed it. But now China entered the war, and China had unlimited manpower, unlimited. And they didn't care how many men they lost. With casualties meant nothing. Sheer weight of numbers drove the American forces again south. And the Chinese captured the city of Seoul again. And then America counterattacked and regained it. But what really happened, America, as you can imagine, was tired of the war. It had 55,000 dead. MacArthur wanted to drop the atom bomb on China. He said that would save American lives and would end the war. Truman disagreed with him. Truman was much more cautious, though Truman was the one that dropped the first two atom bombs. First two were dropped to save a million American casualties in the war against Japan. Yeah.
Wouldn't it make sense that unless they actually killed Mao, that Mao would have said, kill the whole country, I don't care, most likely?
Well,
they had to do to Japan.
The question is that if they dropped an atom bomb on Beijing and on a few other places, the industrial places, and the country couldn't exist. It takes it takes logistics to supply an army. It just wouldn't have existed. Truman and MacArthur had such a bad falling out that Truman fired him. MacArthur was a great hero in the United States. He came back to a tumultuous welcome, the largest ticker tape parade in the history of New York, greater than even when the Yankees won the World Series. They spoke to a joint session of Congress. MacArthur was a very good speaker, a very powerful orator. And he had dreams that he was going to run for president. On the Republican ticket. But the man that eventually got the Republican nomination in 1952 was Dwight Eisenhower, who had been the supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe in the war. And then he was the head of NATO. And Eisenhower promised to end the war. He said he would travel to Korea to end the war. He defeated Adlai Stevenson in 1952 and again in 1956. And he was determined to get out of the war. What happened was that Stalin died, which is something that he didn't figure out in Stalin. He died in 1953. Now, before he died, he had instituted a reign of anti-Semitism, official anti-Semitism in Russia. It was called the Doctor's Plot. He had all Jewish doctors. And he said that they plotted to kill him. And he resurrected the idea that there's a Jewish conspiracy in the world and that the Jewish conspiracy is against Russia and the Soviet Union. And his plan was to exile the 2 million Russian Jews, then there were 2 million, the 2 million Russian Jews to Siberia. Now, Stalin had done that before. He had taken all of the Volga Germans who had lived in Russia for 300 years and exiled them all. Most of them died in the labor camps. He took the Chechnyans. I mean, that's why they're not so popular in Chechnya. He took the Chechnyans and exiled them. He took all the Tartars and exiled them. He took the people out of Crimea and exiled them. You have to realize exile didn't mean, you know, that you moved from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim. Exile meant that you went to Siberia, to the Gulag, to the labor camps. Most of the time it ended up in death. Millions died from these things. And so his plan to do this to the Jews would have been the second Holocaust. But he died. He had a stroke and he died. His compatriots were so afraid of him that even when his body lay dead, they were afraid that to do anything because maybe he was just feigning it. And if somebody came and said, well, you know, let's elect a new leader, let's do something, right? And then he woke up and you're gone. There are very, very good books on biographies of Stalin, especially written in the last 8-10 years since communism, since the Soviet Union fell. If you can get a hold of any of those books, most of them are written by Russians. They're excellent. There also is a book on Khrushchev, which is excellent, because Khrushchev emerges as Stalin's successor. Even though originally they put up Malenkov, they killed Beria, who was the head of the secret police. Every one of the heads of the secret police got killed. It was a job that once you were done killing, then it was your turn. You go to Yezhev, all of them got killed. Beria. So when Stalin died, the Korean War ended. That was the stalemate, which exists today, right? There still is a ceasefire line. Panmunjom is the crossing point, and the North Korea is still a wild card in the world. It's the most closed society in the world. And it's the most brainwashed society. And it's a very dangerous society, especially since they claim to have nuclear weapons. There are lots of madmen in the world. But they're very dangerous. They should never be discounted. The 20th century paid an enormous price for ignoring madmen. Soviet Union became the spokesman for anti-Israel propaganda in the world. Now, Stalin originally thought that the State of Israel would be good for him because it drove out the British imperialism from the Middle East, and also would be good for him because the Jewish communists in the land of Israel convinced him that they were going to run the government. They were going to be able to either make a coup or in the coalition cabinet, somehow they were going to be able to run the government. There was a man by the name of Meir Vilner, who was a famous communist, a few others. There still is a communist party in Israel today. It's mostly Arab today. but it still has a few Jews that are on its list. Ben Gurion, to his everlasting credit, really destroyed them. Now there were in Israel, there was the Mapai, Miflegat Poalei Eretz Yisrael, which was led by Ben Gurion, which was socialist, leftist, but non-communist. That was the majority party. Then there was a second labor party called Mapam, Miflegat Poalim Muchadim, the United Workers' Party. The Mapam was far left, much more left than Mapai. And the Mapam was bitterly anti-religious to an extreme. And its foreign policy favored the Soviet Union. Then on the third level, you had the actual Communist Party, which was just the mouthpiece of the Soviet Union, which proclaimed that it wanted to have a binational state. The Arabs and the Jews together. Now, Stalin had fomented this tremendous anti-Semitism, which became anti-Israel. One of the things that really shook him was that Golda Meir was the first ambassador of the State of Israel to the Soviet Union. She came to the synagogue in Moscow on Rosh Hashanah, and tens of thousands of Jews stood in the street to see her. That shook Stalin, because it showed that the Jewish nationalism, the feeling for the Jewish people, was still alive after 50 years of communism. And because of that, he turned ruthlessly anti-Zionist, anti-Jewish. Nobody here remembers except me, but I remember listening to debates at the UN, where a Russian spokesman got up and said unbelievably the most outlandish things about the Jews and the State of Israel. And much of the propaganda which exists in the world today against Israel and against Jews was originally Soviet-sponsored. The Soviets taught it to the Arabs, and the left in many places in the world continues it today. In the Cold War, Ben-Gurion tried to make Israel a necessary ally of the United States. But the United States needed the oil of the Arabs. And therefore, the United States was never willing, in the 1950s, to put its name on the line that it would somehow protect Israel. So Israel needed weapons, and it needed defenses, because of the fact that after the War of Independence, no peace treaties were signed. None of the Arab countries agreed to make peace. So the state of war continued, and there were daily incidents, unfortunately, like the time that we live in. There were daily incidents, stabbings, shootings, bombings. You shouldn't think that the Intifada began now, or that it began after 1967, or that it began because of conquered territories. That's all baloney. From the first day on, it was here. Then it was sponsored by the neighboring Arab countries, especially Egypt, secondarily Syria, Jordan a little. Now Jordan had annexed the West Bank and East Jerusalem as part of its territory. and said that all the Arabs that lived in the land of Israel were subjects of Jordan, the Jordanian kings. The king of Jordan, Abdullah the First, who is the grandfather of the current one, he at one point thought about coming to a peace agreement with Israel. And the Israelis negotiated with him clandestinely over the years. But because of the fact that the radicals held that he was far too moderate, he was assassinated on the Al-Aqsa Mosque here in Jerusalem, coming out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And his grandson Hussein, who was the next king, next major king — there were two little kings in the middle, one was insane, they deposed him, and the other one didn't last long. But Hussein was at his side when he was shot dead. So people that make peace with Israel or think about making peace with Israel do so at some peril. Sadat was assassinated. It's not a, not easy. And Israel looked to try and control these raids. Then they were called the Fedayeen. It was a terrorist group. They killed children. There was all sorts of terrible stories. Blew up schools. So Israel retaliated. They retaliated either by invading the Gaza Strip and destroying bases there, or invading parts of what was then Jordan, the West Bank, and destroying bases there. Every time Israel retaliated, then the pattern began. The Soviet Union introduced a resolution that Israel's the aggressor. And Israel, I think, has more United Nations resolutions about it than any other country on the globe. And Israel is always in violation of the United Nations resolution. America protected Israel in the fact that it did not allow the resolutions to go through the Security Council, which would have given nations technically the right to take sanctions and arms against Israel. But in the General Assembly, all of these resolutions occurred on a regular basis, and you had these two big blocks, the Muslim bloc and the Soviet bloc, that pushed them over and over again. If you say the same lie over and over again, after a while it becomes the truth, becomes accepted. And that's really what has happened to us, yes?
America single-handedly pushed all this stuff back?
But not single-handedly. They threatened to veto the Security Council. Yet you have a veto power. If you vote no, that 12 countries can vote yes, and America will vote no, nothing happens. Britain, France, China, and Russia, and the United States have veto power in the United Nations. So many times they didn't even have to exercise the veto, they just said they were going to do it, and so then it just never came up again. There was a very articulate spokesman for Israel at the United Nations by the name of Abba Ibn, who was a South African who had a golden tongue, a magnificent speaker, and a magnificent carrier of language and of expressions. And so he became a folk hero in American circles for Israel. Never was regarded very highly here for very different reasons. So you have this situation. Then you further complicated, Russia blows up an atom bomb. So America is not the sole atom bomb. and therefore you have a parity that each side can blow up the other side. You have a tremendous arms race. Now, Russia and the United States both captured the famed German scientists. The Nazis at the end of the war, the Germans at the end of the war, already had jet fighter planes, which the Allies did not have. If they would have had them a year earlier, who knows what would have been. Because the jet plane made all of the propeller planes obsolete. Not only that, the Germans constructed rockets, the V-1 and the V-2 rockets, that were able to hit England. England, at the end of the war, suffered daily from these rockets that fell on London and other parts of England, killing thousands and thousands of people. Tens of thousands were wounded. And the only way that it could be stopped was that eventually the Allies progressed deep enough in Europe that the rockets no longer had the range. But even at the end of the war, there were places in Holland that could still reach England. Now, the head of the rocketry division in Germany was a man by the name of Wernher von Braun. The Americans kidnapped him, and he became the head of the American space program. The Russians kidnapped other ones, and they became the head of the Russian rocket program. I think those that were kidnapped by America had probably a softer life. But both sides used this German technology, the German knowledge, being able to figure this out. And you have this tremendous race. They create intercontinental ballistic missiles, missiles that can be fired from the mainland of the United States and hit any city in Russia. Eventually, they would have missiles on nuclear submarines. I knew a Jewish Orthodox scientist that was a Jewish admiral in the United States Navy by the name of Hyman Rickover. Rickover was a very prickly person. He had very little bedside manner, but he was a genius. And the Navy didn't promote Jews to be admirals lightly. And he was in charge of the nuclear submarine project. I remember as a child, so the project was being developed in Chicago at the Argonne National Laboratory near the University of Chicago. I remember as a, there was a doctor, his name was Alvin Rutkowski, professor, also great genius. And, you know, like he would, he didn't have anywhere to be for Shabbos, he wasn't married yet, so he would be in our house for Shabbos, my mother and father took care of him. So he could sit at the Shabbos table and you'd see he was thinking about something and he was in a different world than we were. But what really struck me, I was like 8 or 10 years old, is that one day there's a knock on the door and there are three FBI agents there. And they wanted to know, what do we have to do with Dr. Rutkowski? And who are we? And, you know, they... My parents were European born, you know, and the FBI comes to the door, it gives you a start. I thought it was great to see the FBI guys. You know, they had all that ties and suits, and sir and madam, and you know. But they were sinister people. And so they created the nuclear submarine, the Nautilus, the American nuclear submarine. And then from the nuclear submarine could stay underwater for forever. Didn't have to surface. Nobody could ever find it. And then they fitted it with nuclear warheads. And, you know, from any place in the globe, they could let you have it. America has that today with its cruise missiles and the other ones that are fired from submarines. So, you know, you had this tremendous buildup of fearsome weapons. The world was always on the edge of being blown up. Now, Israel had no weapons because the United States had an embargo against selling weapons to anybody in the Middle East, while the Arabs were armed to the teeth by the Soviet Union. So two things happened. Firstly, Israel, for the United States, put pressure on Britain, and Britain sold the Israel tanks, the Centurion tank. If you go to the Israel Tank Museum here at Latrun, you can see the evolution of the Israeli tank. Today, the Merkava 4 is an Israeli tank, and you know it does everything but Davin Shacharis. But these were more primitive tanks, in relatively speaking. And Israel was able to buy these tanks, and it gave them a chance, at least, against the T-34s of the Russians. And then an interesting thing happened. France became involved in a war. One of the colonies of France was Algeria in North Africa. And Algeria was not just a colony, it was like Hawaii is a state in the Union of the United States, even though it's 3,000 miles away from the mainland. So Algeria was part of France, just like Corsica is part of France, even though they are not contiguous, they're not connected to the mainland of France. In the early 1950s, there was a revolution against French rule. Again, supported by Russia, but mainly supported by Muslim nationalists. And there was a terrible war that took place for almost 10 years. Again, unspeakable atrocities. Now, France had hundreds of thousands of Frenchmen living in Algeria. And they were hardliners against the Muslims. So the French government, which at certain times had Jewish prime ministers after the war, Pierre Mendès France, one of them. Other Jews in relatively high office. France negotiated a deal. Ben-Gurion sent a young man by the name of Shimon Peres. Peres has put in 60 years of service to the State of Israel, whether you like his politics or not. He's been a key player for a long, long time. And he went and he negotiated so that France agreed to sell airplanes to Israel, because they needed jet fighters. The factory in France that produced the French airplanes, the largest one, was owned by a Jew. And he provided Israel with modern aircraft, which is necessary in any ground war. Anyone that controls the skies is going to win it. But more than that, he got France to help Israel build a nuclear reactor for peaceful purposes, naturally, in Dimona. And from that day on, Israel has never stated that it has nuclear weapons, but almost everyone in the world believes that it does. And Israel did that in order to have a balance of power in the Middle East against the Arab countries who outnumber them 300-1. Uh, this Dr. Rutkowski later, when he retired from the service in the United States, made Aliyah and was a famous atomic scientist here in Israel. And at the same time, he was a chavrusa with the Stipler in Bnei Brak. Very outstanding, different person. Yeah.
What did Israel give to France in return for the planes? What did you say?
You know, it's a strange thing in the world. The world really believes that the Jews run the world. They're convinced of it. So France thought, you know, they'd get business, they get money, they get, you know, something would come out of it, because the Jews run it, right? They didn't give any help in Algeria, and eventually De Gaulle pulled them out of Algeria because Algeria was to France what Vietnam was to the United States. It was an unwinnable war. I mean, it was winnable if they wanted to, you know, to do what they wanted to do, but they couldn't because of world opinion, etc. They just couldn't do it, and therefore it was unwinnable. So this is the climate that we're talking about in the early 1950s. And the you have this tremendous immigration that we talked about last week coming into Israel. You have a very, very difficult economic situation. You have rationing in the country, rationing of food. I mean, when I'm stuck in a traffic jam in Jerusalem like today, there was a major one. I'm standing 10 minutes, you know, not moving. Everybody's honking the horn, you know, but I have a certain feeling of nachas, of accomplishment, right? Because like 50 years ago, there were no cars, right? There were no traffic jams. And Jerusalem had one stoplight, King George and Yafo. Most people drive like there still is only one stoplight. But the truth of the matter is, I mean, you know, look what happened here. You know, and we don't realize how far we have come and how short a time. And if you want to compare it, there are countries in the world that I can send you to, and you'll see what it looks like there. So in this volatile situation, a revolution occurs in Egypt. The old king, we mentioned it last week, the old king Farouk is driven from the throne. Farouk had the greatest collection of pornography in the world. That was his claim to fame. And he was driven from power. And Egypt was run by a military dictator. Gamal Abdel Nasser was his name. Now Nasser had great ambitions for himself. He didn't see himself as the head of Egypt. He saw himself as the head of the entire Arab world, if not the entire Muslim world. And he preached this pan-Arabism. And since Egypt was the largest and most populous country in the area, it was the place to begin with. Now Nasser had a choice. He himself discussed the choice. He had a choice to make peace with Israel, and he could have made it. And basically, had he made peace with Israel, it would have ended the Israeli-Arab conflict on the basis of some readjusted borders. We're talking the 1948 borders. Or to become the hero in the Arab world and to wipe out the state of Israel, much as the president of Iran reminds us every day of his goals. And he also wanted to play the West against the East, United States against Russia. He wanted money, he wanted arms, he wanted all the goodies that he could get. He also had strenuous objection to the fact that England still controlled the Suez Canal, and the Suez Canal is in Egypt. And England had a lease on it for 99 years, and the revenue went to the British company that was operating it, and that disturbed him greatly. As he had a pet project in Egypt, the Nile River floods, or it did flood, every springtime. When it flooded many times, it killed thousands of people and it destroyed homes. There are other years that it was more gentle. So he wanted to build a dam at the headwaters of the Nile that would control the flow in the Nile River and would also provide electricity, hydroelectric power, much as the major dams do in the other parts of the world. I don't know if you've ever seen the great dams in the United States on the Colorado River, Grand Coulee Dam, the Hoover Dam. Just even there they say the dam is only going to last 75 to 100 years and then have to do it again because the power of the water is such. In any event, he wants to build his dam. This dam costs a lot of money, which Egypt does not have. He also wants to rearm Egypt with the latest military equipment. The United States under Eisenhower had a Secretary of State by the name of John Foster Dulles. Dulles was mildly anti-Semitic, certainly not a friend of Israel. State Department has never been a friend of Israel. I think that Mrs. Rice is probably the most pro-Israeli. George Shultz and Condoleezza Rice are probably the most pro-Israeli secretaries of state that America has ever had. In any event, Foster Dulles gave Nasser the impression that America would help him build the dam. And at the last minute, because of politics and the Congress and the budget and all sorts of things which dictators do not understand about America. In America, the president cannot just do what he wants to do. The deal fell through. He's not going to provide the money for the dam. And when that happened, then Nasser turned to Russia, to the Soviet Union, and they said, oh yeah, we'll build the dam for you. Well, now not only build the dam, they sent out they sent in 50,000 Russian technicians, quote unquote, to help build the dam and to train the army and basically to make Egypt the base of Russia, which was their ambition. Now the dam was built. The dam has got all dams affect the ecology in ways that are never foreseen. So in back of the dam there's an enormous lake called Lake Nasser, because he was very modest about things. And Lake Nasser is a great breeding ground for mosquitoes. And over 75% of the Egyptian population suffers from some form of a mosquito-borne disease. And because of that, the life expectancy is much lower and all sorts of things. Because of the dam. The second thing the dam did is it eroded all the beaches on the Mediterranean, because we used to get silt that came down with the Nile River and came into the Mediterranean and came to, let's say, the shores of Israel, and they built up the sandbars and you had a beach. Today you don't have any of that. And that's why it's not just Israel, it's entire. It's Lebanon and Syria and Turkey, all because of the dam. And there are other things that that occurred. The dam also became a liability in case of war, because if it were blown up, Egypt would drown, which was one of the things that Israel threatened Egypt with in the three wars that it conducted against Egypt. It never did it, because the devastation to the Egyptian population would be enormous. Hundreds of thousands would drown. Because in Egypt, almost everybody lives along the Nile. The rest of the country is desert. Cairo has a population, they say now, of close to 18 million. It's a shanty town. If the Nile River comes running down into Cairo, you can imagine it would make New Orleans look like a paradise. So on top of the dam, the Russians also rearmed Egypt. They gave them the latest, best weapons that they had. Nasser, therefore, pursues a policy of aggression against Israel, because he knows that in the United Nations, Russia will protect Egypt. Egypt will never be held guilty for what it does. And he portrays himself as the leader of the Arabs. He's in the forefront of the struggle. And even though life in Egypt is no better than it ever was, in fact probably worse, he's able to divert the minds of the Egyptian people from their problems by making Israel the problem. But that's a situation which exists in much of the Arab world today, right? If only there were no Israel, then, you know, everybody would have Mercedes. And there are lots of people that believe that. Just like in Israel, there are people who believe that there wouldn't be any Haredim, everybody would have a Mercedes. It's a way of creating a scapegoat, creating an other that you can hate, and therefore it lets out your frustrations. So he sponsors these fedayeen, he sponsors these terrorist groups that keep on coming across and murdering Israelis. Until Israel becomes fed up with it. And Ben-Gurion looks for a way to end it. Another point that existed was that under the ceasefire agreement with Egypt, Israel had right that its ships could pass through the Suez Canal, and its ships could pass through the Gulf of Eilat, through the Indian Ocean. And Nasser blocked all of that. So you have this very volatile situation. And now let's put some more pepper in the chon. By early 1956, there are rumblings in Eastern Europe against Russian domination. Stalin had purged the communist parties of Poland and of Czechoslovakia and Hungary. Many of them were Jews that were killed. There was a member of the Israeli Knesset from Mapam who was arrested and served time in jail for being a Russian spy. So great was his loyalty to the Soviet Union. And this resentment finally boiled over. And in 1956, in the fall of 1956, there was a revolution in Hungary. Now, Hungary was the most western of the Eastern European countries. I don't mean western in terms of geography, but in terms of society and mindset. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It never saw itself as, it's not a Slavic country. And this rebellion was such that the government was deposed, the communist government was deposed, and that the new government was formed that wanted to create a Hungary that was independent. Khrushchev originally withdrew the Russian army from Budapest, as though he were agreeing to this, but he only withdrew them to regroup them. And in very bloody fighting, the Russian army put down the rebellion. 50,000 people were killed, and the Hungary was put back under a repressive communist regime. But this touched off a wave of all sorts of things. First of all, a lot of Hungarian Jews got out of the country. Many came here. Many came to the United States. Hungarian Jewry has had a great influence on what world Jewry looks like today, both in the secular and religious worlds. And they were able to escape. I had a neighbor of mine in Miami Beach, wonderful person, real Hungarian. So he said to me, he went to visit Israel. So he said, you know, all of my friends who are communists, they're in Israel. And all of my friends who are Zionists, they're here in Miami Beach. And there was a more than a grain of truth to that. So you had this, and this is happening in the middle of a presidential election in the United States, presidential campaign. Eisenhower is running again. Eisenhower had suffered a heart attack. There was a question about his health. But Eisenhower was enormously popular. So in the middle of all of this, Russia prods Nasser that he should do something about the Suez Canal. And Nasser therefore nationalizes it. He throws out the British. And he says it belongs to Egypt now. That's it. Take it or leave it. And Britain says, we'll negotiate. Forget it. That's it. And the British Prime Minister was Anthony Eden. And Britain felt a tremendous necessity to defend itself. On top of it, you have France that's fighting this war in Algeria. And Nasser is helping the Algerians. And then on top of it, you have the State of Israel, who is interested in toppling Nasser. So this goal made for different and strange bedfellows will lead to a war in 1956 that we'll talk about next week when we get there. When 2 weeks, Purim is in 2 weeks, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so next week we're still on. Good. You want to send this there?